Welcome back to Start Kyle Orton. I'm Travis. Kyle is with me. And Kyle, today, you know, it was kind of a tough game at the start, but the Bears came back, got a great win out there, 15-12. Fantastic day. You know, I had to jet a little bit early, but I know they wrap things up. So, what do you want to talk about? You want to talk about how annoyed you were at the beginning or like?
You might want to just do some quick Googling. I'll wait.
What do you mean?
Just look up the, just type in Bears Commanders. Just
all
see.
Right. Oh dear, Kyle.
Oh dear.
Kyle, I'm seeing something about a Hail Mary being completed.
Hail Mary, full of grace.
Jesus Christ.
The Lord is not with Matt Eberflus. He is not favored in the eyes of God.
You know, Kyle, the intro to this podcast has always been Freddie Mitchell's
same old blues.
And this is kind of a unique sort of blues, isn't it?
Is it though? Because is it not similar to the blues after they blew a game they had a 95% chance of winning in Cleveland last year? Is it not similar to the Blues when they blew a game they had?
There was an almost Hail Mary in that Cleveland game, wasn't there?
A 96% chance of winning in Detroit. Was it the same old Blues as when they blew a 28-7 lead against the Broncos?
That's fair.
That's four games now in Matt Eberflus's tenure where the Bears had a 95% or greater win probability in the fourth quarter. They've lost all four. Someone crunched the math on how likely it was that you would literally lose all four of those games, and the results were literally one in a million. That's how special Matt Eberflus is closing games.
That wouldn't factor in all the games that he has won where he had a 100% chance of. Anyway, don't poke my math brain with that bullshit right now, all right? One in a million. Like, that's the only time the Bears have had that chance of victory. Yeah, okay. So all jokes aside, we lost on a Hail Mary in this game. I know you want to go into some Hail Mary discourse. You know that I hate Hail Mary discourse, so I don't know if you want to start with that or if you want to start with the rest of the game.
What I'll say about the Hail Mary, and we'll get into Tyreek Stevenson later. Obviously, that was a big problem. Yeah. My main complaints about the Hail Mary are actually about the play before the Hail Mary.
Sure.
Where they just conceded the sideline to Terry McLaurin for, you know, a free 15 yards. And what really pisses me off is Matt Eberflus's refusal to acknowledge the importance of that play. He hasn't said that was bad on my part. He hasn't said anything like that. He has said that play doesn't really matter. They would have just converted it to a Hail Mary if we guarded the sidelines. Then fucking let him convert it to a Hail Mary from their own 30. I mean, Jalen, credit to Jalen. He balled. He played, you know, he didn't play his best game, but I thought he made some really good, really tough throws. You could tell the rib injury was taking some zip off of his throws, but was still accurate. And, you know, he managed to get that Hail Mary down there at the end. But even from his own 50 or whatever it was, the ball still came up a little short of the end zone. So if you had that kid launch it from 15 yards before that,
It was obvious enough that Romo brought it up as it was happening. He was like, he can't throw it from here. Mariota maybe can, but Jaden Daniels cannot make a Hail Mary from this point on the field. So he was like, you need to watch the sidelines. I mean, Romo called the play immediately. He was like,
yeah, Romo
throw
called it.
Instant pass to the sideline. It looked like Eberflus knew, but he didn't use one of his three timeouts.
He had three timeouts. He had three fucking timeouts left.
Yeah.
And yeah, also, he came out and said the play didn't matter. Meanwhile, Dan Quinn in his post-game press conference was like, well, thank God we got the 15 yards of the play before that. Without that, we'd have been completely hosed.
Yeah, we couldn't have done anything.
Yeah. So, like, how do you not do that? And also, this is disappointing for me, because one thing we have actually liked about Matt Eberflus generally is that he does tend to do what the analytics tell him as far as, like, when to go for two, when to go for it on fourth down. He's mentioned analytics. Poles has mentioned analytics. Something that I saw that was really interesting is that over the last, I think it was 10 years or so, on plays where defenses rushed only three guys on Hail Marys, the touchdown percentage of those plays is 16.7%. On the Hail Mary plays where teams have rushed four or more, the touchdown only like 3.5% of those has converted. And to me, that makes sense. And that was what I was screaming as the play was happening. I was like, why did you only rush three? Because they were so far back, and Jaden had to take so much time wind up and throw it. If you just sent five guys, if you just hadn't given him 12 seconds to roll around, like if he has to force that throw quickly in any way, if he's not allowed to wind up fully, like you rush his delivery to any way at all, that ball is not reaching the end zone from there. It's not happening. So it was disappointing to me that that staff doesn't know that kind of math, that they haven't done the research to be like, all right, what's statistically better in a Hail Mary situation? Rushing three, rushing four, blitzing. Notably, the Lions a couple weeks ago had a Hail Mary situation. Was it against the Vikings? Yeah, I think it was. They had a Hail Mary situation, and Dan Campbell sent the fucking house. Jared Goff didn't have any time to load up. He got sacked. That to me that makes much more sense than giving him time to load up and actually get the throw. The best way to avoid a Hail Mary is to not let the ball ever fucking get in the air.
That's really my only note on this is the meta of Hail Marys kind of changed. It felt like 5 or 6 years ago. But I know that at least you don't see too many Hail Marys being tried against the Bears. We're usually the team trying the Hail Marys, frankly, for the last however many years. With Iowa, at least whenever that happens against them, the idea is get the sack. Just don't let them throw the damn ball, because you have to load up so hard to get the ball that far downfield.
Yeah.
You just disrupt the throw at all, and there's no way it's going to get even close. So I agree with that. They couldn't sack the damn kid almost the entire game. So maybe that's the thought. But God, watching Jaden out there be so scared to throw that ball on the Hail Mary.
He had 13 seconds.
Yeah.
13 seconds.
He didn't want to throw the ball. He was like, I don't think I can get it down there the whole time. That's why he's floating up.
The worst thing is they rushed three, but they didn't drop eight. TJ Edwards was right there.
Yeah.
At first, I thought he was spying Jaden, in which case I thought that was the dumbest thing I'd ever seen. Because, I'm sorry, you don't trust your guy. I know he's fast. You don't trust your guys to rally and tackle before the dude makes 60 freaking yards on a scramble. The odds of a scramble in that situation actually reaching the end zone are astronomically low. It's not going to happen. Right. So I thought it was a spy. But then TJ Edwards revealed it wasn't a spy. He was assigned to cover Austin Eckler. So if that's the case, I don't know how you tell I don't know how you don't tell TJ, okay, if Eckler doesn't release into a pattern, if he stays in the block, which he did, either fucking immediately haul your ass to the end zone to help out with the coverage, or convert to a blitz. Green dog. Rush the passer.
Why you cover the running back to begin with. I think it's insane.
Yeah, in any situation there, if Jaden Daniels checks down to the running back, that's a win. Bears win. There's no way Austin Eckler is going 60 yards. They're doing pitch play bullshit.
They're pitching, yeah, right.
Yeah, and doing a pitch play after everyone's run down the field for a Hail Mary is really difficult because all of their wide receivers are down there, so you're pitching the linemen and everything else. It's not, yeah. So, yeah, no, I don't want to spend too much time on the specific Hail Mary defense, because shit happens on a Hail Mary. The only things I would say is obviously, and we'll talk about Tyreek in a second, obviously Tyreek fucked up big time.
Yeah.
Obviously, in my opinion, and this was my opinion before that play happens, my opinion of every Hail Mary, I'm a big fan of just fucking blitzing on Hail Marys. It kind of depends on the yard line. If you're inside the 40, then I think, no, you don't blitz. You send more guys in coverage because the QB can probably get a throw of that distance off without having to load up. But when
Shane Matthews, yes.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But if Josh Allen's on your 40,
yeah,
you want to just drop everybody into coverage because, yeah, he can throw it 40 yards on a line, no problem. But at 60-plus yards that they were dealing with, yeah, blitz him. Just make him rush the throw because he's not gonna scramble and throw it off platform that deep. It's not gonna happen. You gotta just rush the throw. And that's that to me. That does get a little bit to Matt Eberflus having the Lovie Smith gene of going too passive in the biggest moments, which he had been doing better at this year, so that really pisses me off. He had been doing such a good job at being aggressive, at pressing guys, you know, at sending blitzes.
I think what it is, the reason Tyreek was acting the way he was acting is because it starts at the fucking top. And I think Eberflus thought the same thing that Tyreek did, which is the game is over. Hail Marys are converted on a less than 10% chance. He's probably just going to get hit anyways. I'm going to taunt the fans. I think Eberflus was giving the same energy, which was like, whatever, yeah. It's a Hail Mary. It's not going to be completed. We won this game. That's awesome. I'm so happy right now.
Yeah.
And I think it just fucking, it filtered down to the guys. And you see it. So the last, usually when a Hail Mary is completed, there's kind of a sea change, right? Depending on how it was completed. There was, for my youth, it became, just knock it down. Just knock the damn ball down. So what happened is, everybody put one offensive player facing the morass of dudes, hoping to catch the ball off the bat, and then to run it into the end zone. And then that happened. Then it was like, don't knock it down. Catch the damn ball. It was blitz them, which is what I thought was still the idea, which is get the quarterback down before he can throw the fucking thing. It was most disappointing to see this Hail Mary completed in the exact way that you, like, it was the knock it down, right? It was the never tip it into the air. Never tip it behind you. There's always one guy back there hoping to catch the tip behind him.
Yeah.
And just that the guy who fucking tipped it was Tyreek. If Tyreek had continued to taunt the crowd and remained out of the play, there is a chance that the Bears win this game and we never...
Oh, yeah, no. Based on the trajectory of the ball, if Tyreek's not there, it goes into Kevin Byard's hand for an interception. Yeah. It's like, it's frustrating all around. And the worst part is
that Tyreek... could not have had a worse play on that play.
And the worst part also is that Tyreek was, according to the assignment, supposed to be the guy covering the last guy in the end zone and breaking up any tip.
Right.
It's just, yeah, it's extremely frustrating. And yeah, I mean, Tyreek Stevenson had a very bad night. And this is another game point that also makes me mad with Matt Eberflus in this game. Yep. I said going into the game, I said, I know Eberflus likes to just put guys on a side and go with it. Cliff Kingsbury then is just going to leave Terry McLaurin on the Tyreek Stevenson side. And I think that's a bad matchup for Tyreek Stevenson. So I was like, I would like to see Eberflus, who's challenged him. You know, he has bucked a couple of his trends this year. So I was hoping, you know, given the other weaknesses in that Washington wide receiver core, you just tell Jalen Johnson, like, Terry McLaurin is your dude. Go wherever he goes. We'll figure it out. They left Tyreek Stevenson on him. Tyreek gave up 5 catches for 125 fucking yards.
That was just awful.
He was abysmal. Then he got that inexcusable personal foul where he fucking hit a guy in the face mask after the play, which is a penalty 100% of the time.
Yeah.
You can't touch the other opponent or the opponent's face at any point without drawing a flag. Before a play, during a play, in a play, you can't do it. So that's inexcusable immaturity from Tyreek there. And then, yeah, obviously not knowing his responsibility, not being in place on the Hail Mary, just inexcusable there. And again, I hear people saying, well, like, well, you can't blame Matt Eberflus for that. The players have to do their jobs. And that's all true. But I've made this point about Matt Eberflus before, and I will continue to make this point about Matt Eberflus. He was hired. The Bears did not do what common sense said they should and hire an offensive coaching candidate. They didn't replace Eberflus last fall or last winter when they could have. And apparently Ben fucking Johnson was hoping for the job. And the logic for it has always been what they've told us is he's a defensive genius and he leadership and culture. Those are the two things they say are Matt Eberflus's superpower. On the defensive genius front, I've been irritated many times that so many of those second-round picks, third-round picks, etc., that they've had, and so much of their free agency money has gone towards giving him all this talent on defense. If you are the defensive head coach, if you are the guy that's an elevator on defense, you should be willing to take a hit and say, I can coach up some of these guys and let those resources go to the offense. Maybe the Bears offensive line would not be in the state that it is if they had been able to spend some second round, third round picks on interior offensive linemen instead of always targeting Zach Pickens and all, you know, and Bayless Johnson wasn't a defensive pick, but God, Bayless Johnson or Bayless Jones. But yeah, so that's always driven me nuts there. Like Matt Eberflus, you can't hype up how he gives you an advantage on defense, and then at the same time, all of your money and most of your draft picks go towards building up his defense. If that's not providing an edge. And the other thing is, yeah, the culture thing. We have heard all fucking long, all for 3 years now about this great culture, about the attention they play to the attention they pay to details, and the leadership and mentoring. It did absolutely jack fucking shit to motivate Chase Claypool. It's done absolutely jack fucking shit to motivate Nate Davis. And now you've got guys, they're like third in the league, I think, in pre-snap penalties.
Yeah.
You see guys not knowing assignments. You see Tyreek doing what he's doing. And now in the last 3-4 days, you have multiple Bears, multiple defensive leaders, team captains, openly questioning Eberflus and his decisions in the media, which I can't remember ever happening. Even during the Trestman era, I don't remember them being so vocal about their concerns. So that tells me that the advantage that Matt Eberflus is supposed to provide as a culture guy and a leader guy, that's not there either. He's not doing that right now. So then it really becomes like, what actually are you then? I think what Matt Eberflus is a decent defensive coordinator. I don't think he's a great head coach. And, you know, the advantage you need to be providing on defense has to be consistent. There should never be a situation where if you're this guy and this is your calling card, where you fucking lose that game after going up 15-12 with 23 seconds left. That should never happen. It's fair to ask why you couldn't. And people will say, well, the offense could have scored more points earlier on, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, if you are a defensive guru and this is your calling card, if you are on defense for the last drive of the game, you need to close. That, like, if you're in that, doesn't matter how, if it's 10-7 or if it's 30-28, whatever, however much the offense has done their job, if they hand the other team the ball and you have a lead and all you have to do is protect that lead and you fail in that situation, as they failed in Washington, as they failed in Cleveland, as they failed in Detroit, as they failed against Denver, then absolutely. It's fair to ask, like, where is this advantage you're providing? What are you providing to us that we couldn't get by, for example, firing you into the sun, getting Ben Johnson and hiring another great defensive coordinator like Robert Saleh? Like, what is it that I'm sorry, but you're the head fucking football coach. It's not good enough to just say, like, well, I've got a pretty good defense. Okay, well, your offense is an open revolt. Your team leaders are questioning you. And you have now made multiple big fuck-ups on defense, closing out games that should have been wins. So I think with all the defensive talent you've assembled, I could just hand this defense to another decent defensive coordinator. I think Robert Saleh could handle this defense. I think Jim Schwartz could handle this defense. And we could actually get someone who does provide a legitimate advantage on the offensive side of the ball, like a Ben Johnson. So it's very difficult for me, and I'm not on fire the guy right now. This is a problem that's going to take care of itself. But if Matt Eberflus can't turn this around and turn it around quickly, I mean, if they lose to Arizona this weekend, it should be 5-alarm fire because you've basically destroyed your path to the playoffs at this point. If you're only 500 after the easy part of your schedule that toughens up immediately after that, pretty much, then I think it's time to. It might be time. I don't know if I doubt they'll fire him in season, but I think the decision should be made pretty quickly that's the move they'll be making in January.
Yeah, that was a lot of stuff there. I'm definitely not in like fire Eberflus right now territory. I do find his handling of post game press conferences to be probably his biggest failing, which is his inability to accept responsibility or even, you know, just pretend to accept responsibility because,
right,
you know, that's what the players are doing as well, right?
Like, right.
When Caleb says, it's all on me, and DJ Moore says, man, I should have been open more helping Caleb out.
Yeah.
And Cole Kmet says, you know, we all need to be playing better as a team. That's, they don't necessarily believe that shit. Maybe some of them do think like, yeah, I didn't like the play calling today, or like,
I'm sure
defense had done this or blah, blah, blah.
I'm sure in his mind, Caleb Williams is probably wanting to say like, guys, I got pressured on 51% of my dropbacks today. The time to pressure was only 2.4 seconds. I didn't have a fucking chance on half of these pass plays. So, right. You know, look at that first. But Caleb Williams knows what a leader does. Caleb Williams has trained for this role his whole life. His answers in post-game press conferences have always been perfect. He has fallen on his sword even when he doesn't have to. So it's notable when Mr. Hits Culture, Mr. Accountability head coach isn't doing that. And the players took obvious notice, because the minute he could have probably calmed down a lot of the fires just by starting off his press conference with that. And his refusal to do so then opened the floodgates for the player rebellion that we've seen. I don't think Jalen Johnson,
Kevin. The problem here, I think, is that, right? Like, this is just a Hail Mary. And I am not like, how dare you allow a Hail Mary to be completed, no matter the circumstances. Like I said, if we had 10 men on the field, that fucking pass probably isn't completed. If Tyreek didn't have an entire game meltdown, you know, we probably win this game. That Hail Mary falls down. We move on. We move on to next week, and we're 5-2, right? But Flew's coming out, and just he seems to always want to protect his coaches, is the weird thing. It feels like it's coaches versus players, almost, where he's like, well, the coaches did everything right. It's the players who need to execute on the plan. And that's what he always says that. It's every single season he comes out and he says the same damn thing. It's just execution, execution, execution. And the problem with that is, it just, you never adjust. If you honestly think that, if you keep saying it and you're just like, no, my plans are perfect, it's the players that, you know, need to conform to it. That sort of philosophy is what we've seen so many times with Bears coaches, right? Like the Mike Martzes of the world, up until Mike Martz was about to be fired, right? It's that whole idea that like, what I'm doing is perfect, but the players aren't doing it perfectly, right? And they need to learn everything and be better in practice and blah, 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 blah. That's your job, right? You mentioned the pre-snap penalties. There are very few things that we can really attribute to head coaches, right? Like sometimes we talk about like, what does the head coach even do? Like, sure, if you're calling defensive plays, I guess we credit you with the defense, but that's kind of weird, right? You have a defensive coordinator. Pre-snap penalties, that's on the head coach. That's discipline. That's, you know, getting everybody to know what the hell they're doing on a given play. How about 12 men on the field? How about a thing we forgot from this game? That dumbass standing in the Washington backfield who got completely bailed out by a false start, a phantom false start by Washington down near the goal line. Would have been a touchdown. Easy, right? They would have had first and goal from the fucking two. They wouldn't have needed to kick a field goal. We wouldn't have been in this game. That's on Eberflus. We have a fucking defender in the Washington backfield gesticulating at Washington for no reason. Like, that substitutions, that's a head coach. Timeout usage. How do you go from wasting all your timeouts to keeping them and not using them at all when you obviously need to use them? When you're obviously flapping your arms around on the sideline like, no, shit, cover the sidelines, right? Don't let them get this yardage so they can't actually throw a Hail Mary. How do you just forget that you
have
three timeouts?
Yeah, you have three timeouts. Take a
head coach.
They should have taken a timeout, had a discussion, guarded the sideline before that second to last play. Take another timeout, have a discussion, make sure everybody knows where they're supposed to be on the damn Hail Mary. There's no excuse not to do that.
This is why you save your timeouts. This is why you want your timeouts at the end of the game. And it just feels like he's been listening to the media, who's been saying like, oh, he blows these timeouts earlier in the game when he could use them later. And now he's just like, ha, see, I kept all my timeouts. But you don't fucking roll them over, Matt. Like, you can use them at the end of the game now that you've saved them. And then all of that in one game, and then to have him come out in the press conference and say, it's all about the players. It's all about execution. Like, do you want to get fired? Is that your idea? And here's the deal. You brought up Ben Johnson. You know, we might as well talk about that now because we're in the head coach portion of this episode. Albert Breer came out a couple days ago and said, Ben Johnson wanted the Bears job. He was looking at the Bears job this last offseason. If the Bears job came open, that's the one he wanted, right? And I think understandably a lot of people were like, God damn it, Bears. Like, could you have just fired him, hired Ben Johnson, and we'd be fixed here? To me, I look at that in a more positive light, which is basically the same way we think about Schefter, right? Why is Albert Breer saying this now? And what is he saying it for? And who is he saying it for, right? Who told him this? Ben Johnson's fucking people, right? That's why he's got this. Why are you saying it now? Probably because George McCaskey is the exact type of dumbass who wouldn't pull a coup on a guy like Matt Eberflus. He probably said last offseason, well, if I fire this guy, and Eberflus is a mediocre coach, but we've had awful coaches before, right? And he's thinking, what if I just hire a worse guy, right? Like, am I honestly going to get a better guy? Why would Ben Johnson want to come here? Doesn't everybody hate me? I'm missing out on Jim Harbaugh, right? Like, I'm not going to get that guy, so maybe I just stick with this guy. To me, this is Ben Johnson's people saying, like, dude, if you fire this guy, why would I want your job less right now than I did before? Before, I didn't know Caleb Williams was good. Now, I've seen him. I know he's good. Now I know you have Roma Dunze. I'm still the offensive coordinator for the Lions. If you've got the money and you don't have a head coach, I'm here. So to me, that was almost like, oh, good. Like, at least he really is interested in this job. Now the question, of course, is George actually going to fucking pull the trigger and pay him the money he wants? And I don't have the answer to that. I know it's that everybody's going to be pessimistic about it.
It's interesting that you think that leak was from Johnson's people, because my suspicion was, who was the guy who was clued in before everyone else on everything that the Bears did this offseason? It was Albert Breer. And Breer got to write the big SI piece after the Caleb Williams draft to talk about Poles' process. He got a lot of access to Poles.
That's true.
This offseason. So that, to me, my ears perked up, because I was like, I wonder if Ryan, because what I have heard from a couple
people. Wow, you think it's a coup?
Well, what I have heard from a couple people is that ultimately the decision to keep Matt Eberflus wasn't really a decision. McCaskey made it pretty clear he was not interested in paying 2 years of Matt Eberflus' salary. Right. So even though I was mad originally at Ryan Poles that he retained him, if that's the case, if it was the McCaskey's doing the McCaskey thing, that does take a little bit of the blame off Poles. And if Poles is leaking to Breer, like, hey, I heard Ben Johnson freaking wants this job, I almost feel like in some ways that's Poles being like, we can make a move here, guys. Like, there is a better option. There is a better alternative. We got lucky that no one hired him last year. We still could get this right. That's how I read it.
I feel like the way that comment is set up, right? Because I feel like if it were coming from Poles, it would be something like, Ben Johnson, very interested in Bears job, right? But instead, it's couched like, Ben Johnson, last offseason, wanted the Bears job. That was the job that he wanted. And it felt to me kind of like, well, Ben doesn't want controversy right now. Like, obviously, he's on a very good team. The Lions could win the Super Bowl this year. Don't say, I'm interested in the Bears job. Say, last offseason, that was the job I wanted, and it didn't open up, right?
Yeah, like, and to me, that was actually my suspicion when Johnson declined all of his other interviews, basically, after the Bears had made it clear that they were keeping Eberflus. That was actually how I felt. I was like, I wonder if he had his eyes on the Bears job the whole time. And we know he's being picky, and I know some people have feelings about that. I think it's smart of Ben Johnson, really, because he... Yeah. You know how it is as an NFL head coach. Like, you don't... If you... And some guys just have to take a job if it's offered because it might be their only offer. Ben Johnson, I think, is confident enough in himself and his results, and he should be, that he knows he's going to get offers from pretty much everyone that have an opening. And I think he was like, I don't think he felt confident in Washington's ownership group. I don't think, and I think he's a North Carolina guy, and I do kind of wonder, my hunch has always been that, you know, Washington very quickly zeroed in on Jaden Daniels from the beginning. Which, you know, hey, I know people are, I was the Jaden Daniels hater. We got to say, Washington's looking a lot smarter right now than they looked. I thought the Dan Quinn hire was uninspired. Yeah. I thought the Cliff Kingsbury hire was uninspired, and those guys are fucking cooking with gas. And Jaden Daniels
fucking cooking. And yes, they struggled in this game. The Bears did a great job containing them, but the Bears are a top five defense in the NFL, right? Like, their struggles were expected, right? Like, kudos to the Bears defense for putting the clamps down on the number three offense in the NFL, but also you know, good job on Jaden not turning the ball over, playing a smart game, getting the ball down the field and taking what he could take. It shouldn't have been enough. I mean, it should have been enough what Caleb did, if not for that Hail Mary. And I don't want to forget that, but yes, kudos to Washington. Like they looked fun. Their defensive line looked a whole lot better than I thought they were, Kyle.
Well, and we'll talk about that in a second too, because
I want to unleash my rage on that. Absolutely.
That's another fucking Chris Morgan thing. But let me circle back to the Ben Johnson thought that I was trying to complete. He turned on the Commanders. He turned on Seattle, I think. Also, he turned on a couple of jobs. Because we know as a head coach in the NFL, you want to go to a team that you know has a good quarterback situation. Because if you don't, and if you don't have a clear path to a quarterback from there. So obviously, Chicago, they had the number one overall pick. He knew, I'm going to get my choice of Caleb Williams, or I'm going to get my choice of Drake May. Because I was saying, he's a UNC guy. I think he's a big fan of Drake May, is what I heard. So I think he was thinking, I go to Chicago, the number one pick. I could pick Caleb. I could pick Drake May. Either way, I'm feeling really confident about what I could do. But, you know, there's a lot of jobs where, like, I mean, look at Brian Callahan? Yeah, Bill Callahan was his dad. It's Brian Callahan.
Bill is the head coach of
the head coach of the Titans right now. Like, he's fucked. Like, I actually think he's done a good job with roster moves and with his hires. His defensive coordinator looks great. But, like, you inherit Will Levis, who's just a fucking idiot. And, like, I don't think you really have a path to another quarterback right now because this 2025 quarterback class looks awful. And you're probably not going to be so bad that you're really picking very high anyways. So, like, what that means is that whatever he does, Brian Callahan's probably fired after next year because he doesn't have a quarterback. So I think Ben Johnson's smart. He's going to go – if he's going to take a job, it's going to be like the Cowboys where he thinks he can fix Dak, or it's going to be the Eagles if Sirianni goes south where he knows he's got that offensive line and he can do all of his cool run stuff that he likes. Or he's going to pick a team like the Bears where he believes in Caleb Williams. And, you know, because if you don't have a quarterback, it doesn't really matter what you do as a head coach. You're going to get fired. So he's smart to wait and pick a good situation. And that's why he turned down the Carolina job, or supposedly made such astronomical salary demands that Carolina had to turn him down. Because, you know, he's like, all right, if I'm going to work for David Tepper, you're going to pay me so much that even if you fire me after 1 year, I'm set for life.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to talk about with Ben Johnson or whomever, let's talk about Caleb and if they do change head coaches after this year. You know, I think both of us were really on the train that, like, I hope they can get at least 2 years with Shane Waldron before they change it out on Caleb so that Caleb has the continuity. Because we have bad vibes as Bears fans from Fields having to change head coaches after his rookie year. Mitch having to change head coaches after his rookie year. Rex Grossman having to change coaches after his rookie year. We have bad feelings for that. So I think we automatically associate that with doom. But I don't feel as strongly about that as I did a couple of weeks ago, because I think the thing that has impressed us both the most about Caleb Williams is that he's clearly very intelligent. He is running everything at the line of scrimmage. He's running all the checks, running all the protections. They have thrown the whole offense at him from day one. Like, he is a 10-year vet, and he's not drowning. You know, there's been some rough moments, but he's not drowning. I think he clearly can adapt very quickly. So I think changing schemes on him would really not affect him as much as some other guys. So I went back and I did go all the way back to the 1998 Manning Leaf draft, because I just generally consider that draft the first modern QB draft of this era. I looked at first and second round QBs who changed coaches after their first year, and whether I felt like they improved under their new coach or whether I thought they regressed or didn't improve. So on the list of guys who did improve, there's Trevor Lawrence, had his best year in year two, which was his first year with Doug Peterson. Then, unfortunately, the league kind of adapted to what Doug Peterson does, and so year three and year four have gotten
hard
worse.
Hard not to have a better year than that weird Urban Meyer year, too.
Right, frankly. But clearly it didn't fuck Trevor Lawrence to change the scheme on him after his rookie year. And keeping Urban Meyer for the sake of continuity would have been disastrous.
Yeah.
Jalen Hurts went from Doug Peterson to Nick Sirianni in his second year, and that obviously had a huge improvement for Jalen. Justin Herbert, I don't know that he improved, but he went from being an outstanding rookie to being an outstanding second-year quarterback after switching from Anthony Lynn to Brandon Staley. So I definitely – it didn't set him back in any way. Justin Herbert's still a top-five NFL quarterback, in my opinion. Definitely didn't hurt him. You know, and then Mitch Trubisky, here's the thing about Mitch. Yes, we get annoyed that the Bears always do this, that they never sync up. Can anyone actually argue, though, with a straight face that switching to Matt Nagy is actually something that hurt Mitch Trubisky? Because if you look at that first year with Mitch under Nagy, actually, if you look at everything Mitch did under Nagy those 3 years versus what Mitch has done since leaving Chicago, I think it's very clear to me that, you know, for as much as they didn't like each other, Matt Nagy was the best coach for Mitch Trubisky. He got more out of him than anyone has been able to get out of him. So I would actually put Mitch Trubisky under the list of a guy who actually improved due to a coaching change after year one. Right below that, a guy who 100% improved. Jared Goff had one of the worst rookie seasons of all time, looked completely hopeless, looked like an all-time bust his rookie year under Jeff Fisher. Sean McVay comes out. He's a top five quarterback in the NFL in that first year. The Rams are in the playoffs. Obviously, the Goff and McVay pairing started to peter out later, but like clearly the switch to Sean McVay saved Jared Goff's career at that point in time. I said the other day, I was like, if they don't switch to Sean McVay there, if they keep Jeff Fisher, then, you know, Jared Goff's probably calling Pac-12 games on TV by now. So, because in 2-3 years, he looks like such a bust, he's probably just out of the league. Some other guys who change after the rookie year, Jameis Winston changed after his rookie year. His second year was statistically probably his best season in Tampa. Marcus Mariota changed after his first year. His second year was easily the best season of his career by every metric. Aaron Rodgers is kind of a tricky one because he really didn't play as a rookie. He didn't really play as a second-year player either, but he switched coaches after his first year from Mike Sherman to Mike McCarthy, and I think we can at least say that it didn't hurt his development in any way. Drew Brees switched coaches after his rookie year. Obviously didn't hurt Drew Brees. Chad Pennington switched coaches after his rookie year. Kind of like Rodgers, it's a little – I mean, he didn't play as a rookie, but still, you can say it didn't hurt his career. And then in this own category, I kind of put Baker Mayfield, because Baker had 3 head coaches in his first 3 years. He was great as a rookie. And it's also kind of weird because the head coach that he had in year 2 when he had his worst year was his interim head coach from the year before. So even if he did regress under a new head coach, it's hard to say that the lack of continuity was the problem, because there was continuity. It was the same guy that he had flourished under as a rookie. So I think that was maybe just the league adapting to what that head coach, Freddie Kitchens, was doing. But in year 3, Ken Whisenhunt come – or not Ken Whisenhunt. Why did I say Ken Whisenhunt? Jesus Christ. Kevin Stefanski comes in. And so for his 3rd head coach in 3 years, which should be considered like just a death sentence for a young quarterback, 3 head coaches in 3 years, his 3rd year – has his best career or best year of his career so far, takes the Browns to the playoffs, wins a playoff game, damn near beats the Chiefs in the playoffs. I think we can say that that coaching change didn't hurt Baker Mayfield at all when he was a young player. And then I'll just list the names real quickly of guys who switched head coaches after their rookie year and didn't improve or got worse. So far, Will Levis, Bryce Young, Justin Fields, Daniel Jones, Dwayne Haskins, Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, Brandon Whedon, Blaine Gabbert, Tim Tebow, Matt Leinart, Rex Grossman, Joey Harrington, Ryan Leaf. So to me, that is, I reading those names, that sure feels to me like when people say switching coaches after year one has historically been really bad for quarterbacks. That to me, I think, is a correlation, not a causation, because I don't think that the downfall of Ryan Leaf was that he was just a really big fan of Kevin Gilbride and Mike Riley caused his decline. I don't think Joey Harrington going from Marty Morningweg to Steve Mariucci was the cause of his decline in any way. I mean, he basically was as bad in year two as he was in year one. Of all those guys I listed, I honestly think the only ones we could maybe argue were hurt by the coaching change are Sam Darnold, who obviously has shown that in a good coaching situation, he can be an effective quarterback at this point. And I do think Justin Fields, for Bears fans, I do think given specifically Justin's issues, which are that he's a slow processor. And so I think I don't know that he would have ever been great, but I think if he had had a second year in Nagy's system, was much more comfortable with what he was looking at, that might have sped him up a little bit to make him a much more effective quarterback. But to me, just reading that list of names, what that tells me is that, like, if you're a guy who's going to be a guy, then that move doesn't hurt you at all. It often helps. If you are a guy who that move seems to destroy, you were probably just always going to fail. Like, Bryce Young's problem is not Dave Canales' new scheme. It's that he's 5'9". Will Levis's problem is not Brian Callahan's scheme. It's that he commits a turnover with every breath. So I really don't think that argument is as strong as I thought it was a couple months ago. And I think having seen how Caleb processes information, how he learns on the fly, I wouldn't be particularly worried if they made that transition, especially if it's for a guy like Ben Johnson.
My God, that was a lot of words to say. It depends on the quarterback. I just nailed it there in 3 seconds. Caleb has pretty much shown over the last 6 games that, like, he's got it figured out. He's not the kind of guy who's going to be screwed up by a head coaching switch, because you would think that would be the case where a guy is just getting used to one system and he can't take the shock of changing to another system. In other words, a guy whose football brain isn't that developed. And, you know, just we know Lincoln Riley quarterbacks aren't like that. We've seen time and time again. You mentioned Jalen Hurts. You mentioned Baker Mayfield. I'm surprised Kyler Murray's coach not change? No, he still had Cliff Kingsbury, who came in there, right? So they maintained with Cliff. But yeah, I think Lincoln Riley quarterback will be fine. And the funny thing is, I texted you after the game, after we had cooled down from that Hail Mary nonsense. And I was like, you know, this game does not make me want to get rid of Matt Eberflus more, but Caleb's play throughout the game made me think, oh, it's totally fine to get rid of Flus and actually bring in a coach who might be able to win a Super Bowl. Because, you know, as I've said before on the podcast, I think Eberflus is fine, but he's not that guy. He's not the guy to take your team to the Super Bowl. He's not the guy to put your team over the top. He's the Vinny Del Negro of the Bears right now, essentially. And that transitions nicely into Caleb's day. I want to talk about Caleb because he started out a bit erratic, I would say. A couple missed passes. A lot of that comes down to horrendous offensive line play. He was pressured on more snaps than he wasn't pressured in this game. But we talked about this earlier this year when he played against Houston. I said the difference in this game is C.J. Stroud knew when to play Ferentz ball and Caleb didn't. Stroud knew, you know what, I can't force it, because if I force it, not only am I not going to get what I want, I'm going to give it away to the other team. So I'm going to wait for my moment. I'm going to stay patient, and I will either take that moment when it comes, or I'll let the other team shoot themselves in the kneecap. And Caleb Williams got frustrated. He was looking at the scoreboard like, oh my God, if they score one more time, we're down 2 scores. And then what do? We're not moving the ball at all. He panicked and he threw the game away. And we talked about it at the time. I was like, as an NFL quarterback, sometimes you learn the 10 for 24 for 130 yards games, as long as you don't have any interceptions, as long as you don't fumble the ball, as long as you take a minimum of sacks and, you know, let your all-world punter go to town like Torrey Taylor did in this game, you'll find a way to win eventually, right? I have watched C.J. Stroud throw for 96 yards this year in a game. I have watched 3 Chiefs games where Pat Mahomes has sucked ass and they have still won. As an NFL quarterback, you aren't going to just go out there and blow people up every game, right? And Caleb did such a good job this game of that. They waited it out. He took what he could. The Bears came all the way back. He did what Justin Fields could never do, and it frustrated us to death.
Well, that's what
he had a final drive. He ran down the clock to 23 seconds. Touchdown. And then he got the 2-point conversion to put us up by three so we couldn't lose on some fucking field goal at the end of the game. It felt so good to finally see a Bears quarterback do that, Kyle. And to have that taken away by the Hail Mary made it very so much worse.
Yeah, I mean, you can see how easily the narrative would be different if that Hail Mary gets batted down. Yeah. All of the talk would be about Caleb Williams shaking off a horrible start and showing real resilience and taking over the game in the fourth quarter. But yeah, I mean, I said this. Like, I have seen this game, this specific game, I've seen it 50 times maybe as a Bears fan where – the play calling feels like active sabotage. The offensive line is a disaster. Nothing's going their way, but the defense just keeps the margin close enough that you're just like, man, all it would take is just two good drives and we could win this thing.
Yeah.
And Fields never delivered. He always got exasperated, it felt like. He always got a little panicked. And the crippling, I mean, Justin Fields' fourth quarter stats as a Bear speak for themselves. Like, when those games happened, he tended to, I mean, I hate to use this term. He wilted.
Yeah.
And Jay Cutler, when these games would happen, you know, if Jay started good, he finished good. If he started bad, he almost always made it worse because he was a big fan of the fuck it interception. You could see the frustration, the impatience start to bleed out. He would always make a bad turn. Caleb just, you know, and you know, the 10 for 24 stat line, like, I think PFF only credited him with three throwaways. To me, that's a misdiagnosis. I watched the all 22. There were, I want to say, probably six of those passes were in my opinion were throwaways, because I think PFF was counting the throwaways out of bounds. But to me, there was a play where they did a play action pass. Rome was the only deep option. It was single high safety. And this I hated this play call by Waldron against a defense playing single high. If they have single high safety, you need to send two guys deep. You have to put the safety in conflict. They didn't do that. They only sent Rome deep. So then the safety is absolutely free without any worries whatsoever, absolutely free to join that corner and doubling Rome. Caleb sees it. It's kind of a play-action pass. It's a little bit of a rollout. It's clearly meant to be Rome or nothing on that play. Caleb throws it deep where nobody can catch it, but, you know, I think that goes down as a miss. To me, that was not a miss. That was very clearly Caleb saying, well, Rome's double-covered. I just got to throw it safely over him, and, yep, you know, this play's a wash. And there was, I think, the screen where it really looked it looked bad because Keenan Allen looked like he had a lot of room to run. And Caleb threw it way over his head, but I don't think Caleb was actually even thinking about Keenan there, and maybe he should have been, but that to me also was a clear throwaway that I think went charted down as a miss. So yeah, he was 10 of 24, but in my opinion, five or six of those incompletions were clear throwaways. So you take those out, he was 10 of 18, in my opinion. And yeah, there were a couple misses early. One of the ones I went back and looked at, though, and again, this is not just me coping about Caleb Williams. I think I would hope people trust us, and especially the way we covered Justin Fields last year, like we're pretty willing to call a spade a spade. When it comes to Bears quarterbacks, trust me, this podcast didn't exist, but like, trust me, we did not spend a lot of time coping about Mitch Trubisky. We were very honest about what we were seeing. But like, to me, that one miss to Rome to the right early on that kind of looked like a wildly inaccurate throw by Caleb on the broadcast view. When you watch the all 22 and you see where the defenders are, where you see where Caleb threw the ball, it's very clear he is expecting Rome to stop and sit in the zone, and he throws it to where Rome would be if he did that. Rome keeps running, which I don't, you know, I can't 100% say who was right or who was wrong there, but Rome kept running, which I don't think makes sense because they were in cover two, and he's basically running right at the crosser, would run him into the zone. So I don't think that was the right decision there. I think he was clearly supposed to settle. So I think what looked like an errant throw from Caleb there definitely was a misfire, where it was just a miscommunication with Rome. There was another play where based on the DB's leverage and there was so much space. Caleb clearly anticipated that Keenan Allen was going to take the back shoulder option. Threw a back shoulder ball. Keenan just kept running, so it lands behind Keenan on his feet. But if you read the, if you look at the field, and if you see it the way Caleb was seeing it, I would also have, and knowing that your wide receivers have options on that route, I would also have expected veteran Keenan Allen to read the corner's leverage and be like, damn, if I just stop here, there's nothing keeping me from catching the ball. So it was curious to me that Keenan kept running, but I don't consider that like a wildly inaccurate throw from Caleb Williams, even though, yeah, it goes in the books as one because it wasn't a catchable pass, blah, blah, blah. It was off target, whatever. But like, if you put yourself in Caleb's shoes and what he's thinking, what he's seeing, that throw makes sense to me. I if Keenan Allen turns around, it's a huge chunk. And I think Keenan Allen should have turned around. I would expect Keenan Allen, one of the great route runners in history, to recognize the corner's leverage and come back just like Caleb did. So, yeah, and there was zero turnover-worthy plays. I know he gets credited with a fumble on the Doug Kramer handoff, but like zero turnover-worthy plays. Actually, only even though he took three sacks, he had a pressure to sack rate of just 15% in that game. He did a very good job of avoiding a lot of pressures. He did take one really ugly sack where he spun out of the initial sack and then went down even harder. You would have kind of liked him to throw it away, but at the same time, that came a few plays after he had spun out of a surefire sack and then scrambled for a first down. So you understand why Caleb has faith in his ability to do that. But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie and say like Caleb played great. He was perfect. Everyone else let him down. But when you're breaking down a bad game by a quarterback, you want to look at like what was bad, and you want to look like, was the process bad or just the results? And that was a game where I thought Caleb's just like Tennessee, really just like Houston up until he did get frustrated late and throw a bad interception.
Yep.
I thought that was a game where Caleb's process was sound. He was clearly reading things correctly. The results just didn't break his way for a number of reasons. So yeah, it was a bad game. You don't have to excuse it or anything like that. You don't have to pretend it wasn't bad, but it's not bad in the way that like really concerns you in any way. Like a Justin Fields bad game, you'd watch and you'd be like, God, why didn't he throw it to that wide open guy? Why didn't he throw it to this guy? Why didn't he do that? Why was he late to this? You know, those things give you concern for his process long term. I have zero concerns about Caleb's process long term. And Kurt Warner kind of noted the same thing. Kurt Warner was like, I thought Caleb managed a bad situation pretty well. Shane Waldron did not give him a lot of opportunities to make big plays.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the reasons that Caleb didn't have those opportunities. I'm not going to sit here and shit on Shane Waldron too much for this game. I think my headcanon from what I saw of this game, I think Shane thought, there is no way that defensive line is going to give us so much trouble that I am going to have to change everything I thought I was going to do in this fucking game. There's no way. They're not that good. And I think even as it was happening, even as our offensive line was getting absolutely fucking destroyed, he thought, surely this cannot continue to this extent.
Yeah.
Because we played well against the Jaguars, who are hypothetically a better defensive line. We played very well against the Panthers, who are a terrible defensive line. But like, Washington's a lot closer to Carolina than they are to Minnesota. And I think he was completely fucking baffled. And it took him more than a half to be like, okay, our offensive line doesn't fucking work. Like I just have to run completely different from Caleb at this point. And yeah, it comes down to the offensive line. I saw so many people taking blame after this game. And I know maybe people are just tired of it at this point, but earlier this season, I said, hey, let's chill. You know, these offensive linemen haven't played this bad before. Like, obviously, Dardale Wright has been very solid all season. But, man, like, Braxton Jones hasn't been playing well. Tevin Jenkins hadn't been playing well. You know, we got a rotating door there at right guard. And then our center's a backup. Like, oh, they're all playing a new scheme. Give them time. Give them time to gel. You know, maybe it'll get better. At this point, I'm willing to put a tombstone on it. This was fucking reprehensible. This was one of the worst collective efforts outside of Dardale, who played a great game. That I have yet seen out of this team. Like, honestly, I thought that I could expect them to be acceptable now against like bottom half of the league defensive lines. Like, yeah, you're going to give up a couple sacks because you're not that great, but you aren't going to get steamrolled. This Washington defensive line has no juice, and they made jokes of almost everybody on the Bears'
defensive line.
It was disgusting.
Well, and just like the Houston game, it wasn't always talent. It wasn't always guys getting plowed over. It was missed communications. It was free rushers, even though Caleb did the math correctly. There were five guys, four or five rushers, but someone was missing a block. Someone didn't hand off a twist. Someone didn't end up a stunt. I gave Dan Quinn credit, but a Washington fan that follows me on Twitter actually was like, I understand why people assume this, but actually Joe Witt is the defensive coordinator and does the defensive play calls. So it's actually not Dan Quinn. But their defensive coordinator had a brilliant game plan to exploit the Bears' protection calls. Obviously Kieran Amagaji, when he had to come in, had a rough couple drives, but actually sort of got better as the game went along.
Pretty good by the end of the game, actually.
Unfortunately, now he's apparently got a calf injury, but he's got a lot of talent. I think that is a guy, you really didn't want to have to play him this year, but like the tools are absolutely there.
Romo called him out on a play that I thought was very unfair, where he said, oh, you always have to take the inside guy on that. Tevin Jenkins crashed down and sealed off the right side. Kieran was on the left all by himself with two guys. And Tony Romo's call was, well, you always take the inside guy. And I'm like, all right, sick. So he takes the inside guy, Tony. What does he do about the defensive end that's running right at Caleb then? Like, are you sure there wasn't another problem on this play? Do we really blame Kieran for picking one of the two dudes who split him?
Well,
like, I've seen Bears offensive linemen let both guys go around him and stand in the middle of them. Like, to me, I mean, you hit the fucking nail on the head. Like, I don't want to blame Shane Waldron for too much because I have liked a lot of the stuff that he has done. And I specifically appreciate what he's doing with Caleb and how he's bringing him along. I think it's going to be terminal for Shane's career, but I think it's going to help Caleb out a lot long term, and we're going to owe him a great debt. But, oh my God, one thing that he is fucking up right now is teaching his offensive linemen how to fucking see blocks, see stunts, see anything that these guys are doing on the other side of the ball. They seem so fucking confused.
Well, and this has been a continued weakness of Chris Morgan's offensive line specifically. This is a three. It's why I didn't understand why Chris Morgan was retained. They don't seem to communicate well. They don't handle their assignments very well. One thing I'll say is I do agree with Romo on that, because blitz protection rules are you take whichever guy is closest to the quarterback to begin with. So if it's if there are one guy coming from the outside, there's one guy coming from the interior, you do take the interior guy. And then it's on Caleb to recognize that there's a free edge rusher and that's his guy to make miss. So he knows he's hot. He's got to hit the route. So I actually think Romo is right on that in terms of protection rules.
So in that case, you would say Caleb should have rotated his running back to the left and said, you need to get a chip on this fucker.
Right. That would be Caleb's guy to either point out to the back, or you just let him come as a free rusher and it's Caleb's job to replace replace the blitz with a hot route. So, Caleb just knows, like, catch the ball, throw it on a quick slant or something like that. I thought Amagaji, a lot of talent there. Fortunately, it does sound like Braxton Jones, his injury is not that serious. We should hopefully maybe have him back in a week or two. But for now, I think this with Amagaji having a calf injury, looks like we're getting Larry Borum back.
We texted each other during the game where I was like, oh my God, I've never prayed so hard for Larry
Borum.
Not available to me right now. Yeah. Like, for one game, against the Cardinals, who are the only defensive line in the NFL commensurate with the Carolina Panthers right now. They paid Justin Jones $10 million a year to be trash. So I think Larry Borum should be fine there. On the other hand, I really thought we'd be fine against Washington. And I was disappointed. So
yeah. Well, and again, it keeps coming down to scheme and their blitz protections. It's not, and now I will say Coleman Shelton, it was a bad matchup for him versus Payne and Johnny Newton, because Coleman he's a little light in the ass for a center. And Payne is a big, fast dude. And then also Johnny Newton, who I love, obviously, has a very violent punch. And so, you know, it really messed with Coleman's anchor. So that was the one matchup that they were just straight up losing. Tevin was actually doing pretty well before he went out. And I've heard there's some optimism that he might be back this week, maybe. But
well, it wasn't his neck. It didn't look like, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. But yeah, that was the only like physical matchup that I thought they were consistently losing was Coleman Shelton. The rest of it, again, was just shitty blitz pickups, shitty not handing off twists, not handing off stunts, allowing free rushers, which is why the time to pressure was so fast. And that just doesn't give Caleb a chance. And that's something that like Chris Morgan needs to fucking find answers for. It's an inexcusable that this keeps happening. And you're not that far away from Mark Halfley in Green Bay, who has been doing some really creative shit with his pass rushers. And you're not that far away from the necromancer himself, Brian Flores. So you have to have better answers before those games. You have to.
Yeah, and there is, I mean, this circles right back around the coaching. We can end this where we started, but at this point, I have no hope for our offense doing anything against Minnesota or Green Bay. We are going to get absolutely trashed. Those defensive lines are so much better than Washington that there is no comparison. They aren't in the same ballpark. They aren't in the same fucking city. Like, if you can't block what Washington is doing, you can't block one quarter of Brian Flores' playbook. It's going to be an absolute fucking mugging. And it comes down to the coaching. And this starts with Eberflus, and Eberflus will not take responsibility for it. And I feel like we have our answer, right? With what he said in this press conference. You're always asking, why was Chris Morgan retained? Why is he still here? Eberflus does not hold his coaches accountable. That's what it is. He just never holds them accountable for anything. They never do anything wrong. It's the players who do things wrong. It's the execution of the players that is wrong. It's never the game plan. It's never what the coach is taught. It's always on the players. And when you have that mindset week in and week out, you don't get better. And shit like this keeps happening. And you're in year three and your offensive line still doesn't know how to pick up a goddamn stunt. And that's where we're at. Honestly, I start off getting mad at Ryan Poles about this. Like, why don't you draft more guys? Why don't you go out and buy more guys on the free agent market? But it's probably not that, right? Because we know several of these guys have a ton of talent. We know Tev and Braxton and Darnell have great talent. We know that he tried, you know, in getting Ryan Bates. He signed Nate Davis, a malcontent who, oh, glorious culture man, Matt Eberflus, should have been able to make a play and just love the team and suddenly become like a fucking Belichick guy, right? It's so apparently coaching at this point that it's impossible to ignore.
Yeah, I mean, the old expression is you are either coaching it or you're allowing it to happen. And it feels like there's a lot of allowing it to happen right now.
Exactly. So I think, yes, the lasting image from this game is going to be Tyrique Stevenson looking at Bears fans and pointing at them while the Hail Mary play has been snapped and is running behind him. Absolutely. But I do not think that is going to be the final image for Tyrique Stevenson. I don't think that's going to be the headstone image for Tyrique Stevenson's career. But I do think maybe it's going to be the headstone image for Matt Eberflus's coaching career. I think maybe that right there is why Matt Eberflus gets fired. Because if you are who you say you are, Tyrique fucking Stevenson isn't doing that.
Yeah.
Period. So, Kyle, we didn't get to talk about Arizona much. I've been texting you this all week. Arizona is a real coin flip of a fucking team. Either you land on heads and they look like they're definitely in the playoffs. They look like they're going to win their division. You land on tails and they look like the Panthers. I sure as shit hope that we get the bad version.
I think they're a good offense that's really starting to come around. And I've always been bigger on Kyler Murray than a lot of people. I think he's a very good NFL quarterback. But you would still expect the Bears defense, especially because I do think they possibly get Brisker back this weekend. Doesn't sound like Kyler Gordon, but they're getting healthier on defense for sure. I would expect the Bears defense to slow them down a bit. Everything's going to come back to, can this offensive line, because this is not a good defensive line in Arizona, but Jonathan Gannon does try some shit. I'll say that. He's a guy who likes to try a lot of shit. And I think, again, if he is able to exploit their blitz protection schemes the way that Washington was, it doesn't really matter that their defensive line is bad if you're getting free linebackers through. So that's going to be a challenge. So it's very hard for me to be confidently predicting victory for the Bears at this point, like I was a couple weeks ago, because the things we thought they had maybe fixed a little bit, or at least fixed versus bad teams, have now been broken again.
The doom and gloom thing to say, and it's not out of the question, is, well, guess what? Teams have enough tape now.
Yeah.
And this Washington game maybe was the game where people had enough tape of the Bears and they're like, oh, dude, it's so easy to get pressure on them. Like, their offensive line doesn't know what they're doing. And they're just going to spam the same plays, confuse them, get pressure on more than half the downs. Like, if Washington could do it, I don't see why Jonathan Gannon and the Arizona defensive line, as shitty as they are, can't do it. And that's the fear we have to live with for the rest of the season. You mentioned it, Kyle. We're 4-3 now. We're not 5-2. I said at the beginning of the season, if you think the Bears are going 9-8 or 8-9, you think the Bears are either going 7-2 or 6-3 to start the season, because these last eight games are awful. It's going to be hard to, if we go 500 in these last eight games, that's a massive success. Yeah. If we lose this game, we start the season 4-4. This season could very possibly end 6-11.
Yeah.
At that point, Eberflus is gone for sure.
Yeah, if they manage to pull out a win here against the Cardinals, and they pull out a win against the Patriots, and they get to 6-3, then I do like their chances of potentially a winning season, because I think you probably steal at least one division win somewhere. I do think they could probably beat Seattle at this point. So right in there, that would be 8 wins there. And then you just need one more out of, you know, maybe you get a second division game, maybe beat the 49ers, who don't look quite as scary as they have in recent years. Like, there's, you know, that's potential. But you lose either of these next two games, and yeah, it starts becoming about, this season goes entirely back to, well, I just want to see Caleb Williams do some cool stuff every week. Hope that he shows some development, and you just start counting down the days till Matt Eberflus has to clean out his office. It's that simple. And I did note that, you know, we're all worried that they'll do the same thing they did last year. And if they get to 8-9, they'll be like, hey, 8 wins with a rookie quarterback's pretty good. You can't fire Matt Eberflus for that. That's my biggest fear. But Courtney Cronin, who is probably the best current beat writer on the Bears beat, works for ESPN. She's very clued in. She's always got her finger on the pulse at Halas Hall the last couple of years. She made it very clear that, she said, the feeling around here, which is her way of saying, like, what people here are telling me, is that it's playoffs or bust for Matt Eberflus at this point. Yeah. So
I think with this knowledge that Ben Johnson is like, I like that team and I would like to coach him, I think for sure. But yeah, also there's a difference. Last year, the Bears won down the stretch. This year, if the Bears are at 8-9, it's because your ass beat down the stretch.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The momentum is a big thing. So I also think what was I gonna say? And this is a situation that will I think we're kind of zen about this compared to a lot of the fan base, because this is a situation that either way then is gonna work itself out.
Yeah.
Because either they are going to figure it out, go on a run and make the playoffs, in which case, yeah, maybe long-term it's bad that Eberflus keeps his job, but at the same time, if he's able to rally from this and make the playoffs, he's doing something right. And if they don't rally from this and don't make the playoffs, and apparently he's got a playoffs or bust mandate, then good, we'll get fucking rid of him. But, you know, I'd be a lot more worried if Caleb was having Justin's rookie year, where you were like, yeah, there's some flashes, but man, he needs a lot of help. He's really far away. So this coaching change could really fuck him. I don't feel that way about Caleb. I think he's ready to go. He's showing signs. He can handle it. You bring in Ben Johnson, I think he and Caleb will gel from day one.
And I know we're kind of counting chickens here. It doesn't necessarily have to be Ben Johnson, but if it were, that dude's offense fits Caleb exactly. That's
another name.
Match made in heaven, man.
Another name I would like, if it's not Ben Johnson, is Todd Monken. So he does great stuff in Baltimore. Todd Monken's always done great stuff everywhere he's been. In Georgia, he was people like Dirk Cotter scapegoated him in Arizona, but like he got a year where both Ryan Fitzpatrick and Jameis Winston averaged like 9 yards per attempt. I've always been a fan of Todd.
An interesting one. I do like Todd. I like give me that other Harbaugh. I don't really mind, but it doesn't have to be Ben Johnson. But there is a point at which the coaching failures just get to me too much. I'm like, this cannot continue. Like the things that this guy is bad at are too many, and they are too obviously attributable to the head coach. And it feels like it is seeping down into the Bears organization at this point.
And again, if they had hired a Ben Johnson and your offense was scoring points, but you know, like there were fuck ups on defense, you didn't close out a couple of games late, like you're not as mad at the head coach for that, because like, well, the advantage that Ben Johnson was supposed to bring to us is the offense, and he's doing that. When you're talking Matt Eberflus, the advantage he's supposed to bring to us is basically a defense that should never have a late game collapse like that, and it's happened 4 times now. And also, he preaches his culture and his discipline and hits and all of that stuff. And so when you have these mental lapses, these penalties and everything, like that's pretty damning too. Like this is supposed to be your edge, man. So I am holding you to a higher standard because that's the standard you set for yourself.
Yep. So. Yeah. I hate to end on a down note, but I am feeling quite down about
this. It's a down right game. Now.
I mean, look, they're 4-3. They're one stupid fucking pass away from being 5-2. It's just the circumstances, not the Hail Mary, but the way Flus handled that post-game press conference, the way he has handled it in the week since, that really... The way the players have talked, you know, just openly shitting on him in the media, where I'm like, it feels like this is about donezo. You know, it feels like he's a lame duck at this point. And that's frustrating with a 4-3 team. This is probably going to be like the best Bears season we've had for what, 6 years since 2019. And yet here we are, we're dealing with internal mutiny because a fucking Hail Mary got completed.
And I mean, winning cures everything. So if they do rally and they win these next two, you could see him start to lock in for the divisional play, and maybe things get turned around, and that will be a credit to him if he's able to do that. But yeah, it feels this right now. I mean, it's sucks to say about a non-division game against an NFC West opponent in week 8, but it's 100%. It's a must win.
You have to win this game.
If you lose this game, like the vibes will be fucking rancid.
Yep.
So. Yeah,
you said maybe he could get fired. Like being fired at 4-4 would be insane. But the vibes feel that way in Chicago right now. It feels like, buddy, if you blow this and we see what's coming, we're just going to let Waldron coach this fucking team out, and then we'll let him fly away. You know?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I didn't. Right, you got anything else you'd like to say?
No. Let's hope we're back here next week talking more positively. I'd love to just talk about a Bears win. Love to talk about another good Caleb game, but you know, feels a little less, it's not as easy to be as confident in that as I probably felt a couple weeks ago. So
absolutely. All right. Well, see you next week.
Oh yeah. Way out on that bumper floor. Now you know I'm leaving Chicago. I sure do hate to go. Now you know I'm leaving.